Ladies and gentlemen, I know you're still in nip-chicken mode, but we need to press on. And we are very fortunate today to have Michael Dunn as a speaker, who I'll introduce in a moment. I just want to remind you two things. One is the boring thing about you do get shot if you leave your telephone on. And we have an event tomorrow. My children have been poisoned. China's lead poisoning, public health crisis. This is a talk with Joseph Amon. There are still seats available, so if you'd like to sign up for that, that's for tomorrow. Let's turn to today. Our speaker today, if you've ever read anything about the automotive industry in Asia, you will know who Michael Dunn is, because he's forever being quoted. The reason he's forever being quoted is he knows a lot about the subject. He is from Detroit, so it's in the blood, born with a car stuck in his mouth. His father also, I just discovered, has been very heavily involved in the industry, annoying industry manufacturers by taking pictures of their models before they wanted to release them. And now we have Michael Dunn, who has been in this region since the 1990s. He's started and sold one company that has been devoted to automotive research, which was sold to J.D. Powers. He now has his own company, which by remarkable coincidence is called Dunn & Company. And he spent, I'm not quite sure how long it took you to do the GM book, but he spent the better part of a year talking about one of the great stories in the automotive industry, which is about General Motors in China. We're now talking about the biggest auto market in the world, and General Motors, as is in their slow way, have caught up with that information. And here is the book that tells you everything you want to know. I have to say, and I apologize for this, it definitely is not our fault, but we were hoping to have the book available here. Unfortunately, it hasn't been shipped into Hong Kong yet. It will be in bookshops, I would say, within about 10 days, something like that. So, and incidentally, we are going to make an arrangement, almost certainly with Dimex, so that FCC members can get a discount on books that are mentioned or are the subject of talks here. So sorry the book isn't here. I, for one, certainly want to read it. I'm sure you do too. But let me hand over to Michael Dunn.
Stephen, thank you very much for that kind introduction. It's great to be here. And it's always enjoyable to talk about cars in China. I think by now all of you know China's the largest car market in the world, surpassed the United States last year. But that's not nearly as interesting to me as the question of who's in charge of China's auto industry. And by in charge, I mean who's in control and who's going to get the money at the end of the day. China has never made a secret of its ambition to have its own auto industry and export cars globally. At the same time, global automakers like GM make no secret of their ambition to capture, own Chinese consumers now and forever. China puts forth a law that says if you want to sell your cars in China, you must build them in China, and you must partner with us, the government. Half of every car company in China, at least half, is owned by a local or central government. This makes for a very, very awkward relationship, one in which GM has found its way to making record numbers of cars and profits. The question is, are they ultimately in control? Now, as a short aside, I think it's always important when I'm in Hong Kong or in China to just build a little bit of credibility. You say, who's this guy from Detroit, white guy, what does he know about China or cars? So in 1986, it was my first year in China, went directly to Chongqing. Didn't everybody in 1986? And I was picked up at the airport in a light blue car called the Shanghai Sedan, which was based on a 1955 Chrysler Imperial. Lumber, big bench seats, gear shift on a tree, big steering wheel, and we pulled into the university, Chongqing, 10,000 people, and I said, I just got one question. Whose car is this? Like to know, you have one car here, who does it belong to? It belongs to the nation, Okay, the nation. All right, I don't quite get, I'm from America. No, the nation doesn't own things, at least in those days it didn't own things. What does that mean? Guojia? And I said, who exactly? So they said, well, everybody here in the university, from the president to the school kid, everybody owns this car. So the next day, naturally, I woke up and I go, I got the point, so I went and asked him. Since everyone owns a car, can I just take a spin around the city? And with that, I was met with nervous laughter. No, that's not how it works. You got some things to learn here before you get going into what we're in China. So that was the beginning. At that time, China didn't really make many cars. It made hundreds of cars a year only. This is 1986. They needed to build an industry, and their leader had a vision for it. What are we going to do? We want to build our own cars. How are we going to make that happen? So Deng Xiaoping made a visit to Japan. He said, this is easy. What we do is we direct our three biggest cities, Guangzhou, Beijing, and Shanghai, to partner up with foreign companies, form joint ventures. We learn how to build cars. After 5-10 years, we'll put our own names on those cars and we'll be off and running. Form JV, learn technology, do it ourselves. If Deng were to come back today, he would be highly disappointed. Why? Because the very first joint venture, Shanghai Volkswagen, is still today, 25 years later, still making this Santana, the car that they built 25 years ago. He would be mortified to see that China hasn't advanced any further than assembling cars under somebody else's branding. Now, the reason this has come about is a little complex, but it is also quite simple. Deng also gave orders, as we all know, to decentralize power. This is how we're going to reform and open. Let's let the economy blossom. As a result of this, every province and city would like to have its own car industry and car company. Deng's vision, three cities, consolidate, learn, do it ourselves. Reality is, it's the Wild West. Just yesterday it was announced that Saab is being invested in by young man, Zhejiang young man. I've been doing the auto industry for, I don't know Zhejiang young man. They're just coming out of the woodwork, companies with ambitions to be kind of auto industry. As a result of this fragmentation of the industry, you have the most fragmented market in the world. Only one car maker, Volkswagen, has more than 10%. There are 72 brands competing for share. If you look, SAIC, Beijing, and Guangzhou, the initial three, the Vanguard, aren't even in the picture. They don't even have 3% market share. In fact, the only Chinese brands that are in the picture are Geely, BYD, and Chery. These three companies, ironically, were never part of the government's plan. You've got a really messy situation where China is saying, we want our own industry, but we're shooting ourselves in our foot. How do we take control of this thing? It's a mess. Their vision, if you're Chinese, is that, say, 5 years from now, China should have at least 50%, probably 60% of its market. Today, it's at 30%. And the global automakers' view is, let the Chinese automakers make the small, cheap cars, 30% of the market, and hold it there. They have no business increasing their market share. Okay? That's to give some context. Now, how does GM work itself into the picture? I mentioned at the outset that what is of real interest to me is who's in control and who's in charge. So to get there, I just want to share two stories from the book. The first one occurred leading up to GM's entry into the China market. China desperately needed a modern, full-size sedan that its government officials could drive around cities in, central government, local government. They didn't know how to make it. They're still making the old Santana. They went to Buick and to GM and they said, guys, we got a great opportunity for you. Invest with us, Shanghai. Build a full-size sedan, and you will have a monopoly over that segment. Large car, big price, big market. So for the better part of 4 years, Ford and GM knocked heads, trying to outbid each other for the rights to invest with SAIC to build these big cars. That was 94, 95, 96, 97. 97, the chairman of GM, Jack Smith, says, I got the picture. The only way we're ever going to beat Ford is to tell you, SAIC, whatever you need, we're ready to transfer. You need cash, here's $1 billion. You need tech transfer, we're going to do it. You need management, we're all in. And with that statement, that was persuasive enough. SAIC said, okay, GM, you win. You're our partner. You're going to build this car with us. GM was just so happy. Happy to get into China, even happier to defeat Ford, the Tarch rival. Ford, go home. We got the JV with SAIC. We won the game. Watch this. Now, only 6 months later, executives at GM hear a story. Rumor. There's a rumor that Volkswagen, who's been making this Santana forever, is going to begin producing the Passat, which is a direct competitor to the Buick from GM. They're going to be making it in Shanghai with SAIC across town. Now, naturally, guys at GM go, this is absurd. Couldn't be. Everyone in the world is clear. There was a bid. We won the bid. We have that segment. So they went over to their partners at SAIC and said, please, help us kill this rumor. This is craziness. Please confirm that this is not even remotely possible. So the guys at SAIC were kind of expecting the visit. And their response was, well, guys at GM, imagine you're a father and you have two sons. Huh?
Yeah.
How can we give you the chance to build this car and not give it to Volkswagen? With that pithy few words, everything in GM's world was turned upside down. And I know the guys at GM, speechless. What? And what's their alternative? What's their option? Okay, well, here we go. So GM got into business. Volkswagen started making their competitors with the same partner. As luck would have it, the market took off and both have prospered. But it was an early indication of when crunch time comes, who's really in charge in China. That was one. That was a long time ago, 15 years ago. More recently, you guys will recall, second story. 2009, GM is flat on its back in North America, going into bankruptcy. Europe division, Opel, also on its back, for sale, up for sale to a Russian, Canadian, Belgian consortium. GM's desperate for cash. Only in Asia Pacific do they have some money. And here in China, they had a 50-50 joint venture with SAIC, making record numbers of cars, record profit, no problems in China. But there was a major foreign exchange problem in Korea. People guessed that the yuan would appreciate against the dollar. It ended up depreciating against the dollar. 2009, imagine, suddenly Korea owes $1.5 billion to the banks. You go, okay, so big deal, Forex. No, big deal. They can't get money from North America, can't get it from Europe. GM is desperate. What are we going to do? Who had money? China had money. So through the Chinese partners, quietly, it was arranged that GM would get a loan. And in the fall of 2009, they said, we're buying back. No problem in Korea. We'll pay off the loan. We're okay. And, oh, by the way, Opel is no longer for sale. They did a complete U-turn, which really upset a lot of people. We're not selling Opel. Where did they get this money from? They never said publicly, but they got their hands on some money, and they're able to save their Korean operation and Europe in a matter of weeks. In December of 2009, there was a small announcement by GM. We've decided, jointly with SAIC, to sell 1% equity to Shanghai. We've been 50-50 partners, best friends forever since 1997. Now the relationship is 51-49. And with that, the Chinese side now has the authority to appoint the directors to the board, to set strategy, and to decide on budgets, funding. Is there anything else? Yeah. So GM needed the favor. It got the favor for loans. GM gave up 1%, sold 1% for about $80 million on a $20 billion enterprise. It looks like a gift. This story's not over, because just last week, the CEO at GM's annual meeting in Detroit was asked, why, in your such an important market, you only have 49%? And he said, don't worry, we have an option to buy that 1% back, and we intend to use it. Now, he said that prior to that, GM guys were saying, doesn't matter, 50-50, 51-49 is the same. So the CEO last week said, no, we're buying it back. And the folks at SAIC came out and said, I don't think so. They didn't say no, but, you know, provided that GM could meet certain criteria, then and only then would we be willing to sell the 1% back. That's why we bought the 1% in the first place, the quote ends. If you look at GM saying China is their savior going forward, it is true that they've done a fabulous job of marketing the Buicks and Chevys. Chinese customers love the product. My only question is, who's in control of GM's destiny going forward? And that's really the heart of the book. Yeah? With that, I'd like to pause. And Stephen, open up the question. The most exciting part. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Okay, we have usual 20 minutes for questions, so who would like to ask the first question? If not, I will. Presumptuously. Let me just ask you a general question about the Chinese auto industry. It's essentially a domestic industry now. When do you think it's going to become an export industry, or will it?
You're right that exports are a tiny fraction of total production today, but we can see movement among the Chinese automakers in particular to ship their cars to developing markets. Not yet to the U.S., Europe, or Japan, but to places like Middle East, Africa, and South America. I think 10 years from now, it'll be millions of cars a year coming out of China going to both developing markets and developed markets. One of the stumbling blocks is that joint ventures don't want to export from China. If you're Volkswagen or Hyundai or Toyota, they don't want it because half of the revenue goes to the car. They'd rather supply this other market from other places.
Given all the bellyaching on capital and about the trade deficit, why on earth isn't GM just exporting parts to China?
They'd love to. The tariff is there. So you still have, even after WTO negotiations, China still has significant tariff barriers, 25% import duty. Then on top of that, depending on the engine size and other things, it's another 70% VAT, engine tax, etc. An imported car costs about double of priced at about double of what it's priced at if you produce it inside China. So they kind of have to produce inside China.
I'm sorry, I keep forgetting to tell people you should identify yourself.
My name is Martin Saff, I'm an associate member. The point of your story about who's in charge, about the Passat and the Buick, I take it, is the Chinese joint venture's in charge. So if the Chinese joint venture, as is rumored in the press, says it wants to produce its own local brand, won't that effectively put these joint ventures or the foreign partners and joint ventures out of business in the next 5 years?
You're right. SAIC does have its own brand already. They produce over 100,000 cars. They are directly competing with the products from Buick and Volkswagen. And if any of us walked into any situation and said, okay, what are the rules of this game here? Okay, I can only own 50%. You can own 100% of your own brand. I'm going to produce a car across town. My competitor's producing a car. Hold on. These rules, when I came to Hong Kong yesterday, it said a fair level playing field for all. So I was kind of going, this is not China. This is Hong Kong. It's not level at all. If the writing's on the wall foreign automakers are doing everything they can do to hold on. Because, exactly as you say, they have their own brands, they have their own plans.
Joe, over here. I represent an energy power group, and a number of our members, IPPF, are involved with fuel cell technology, development of automotive support systems for the emerging electric car industry. Mm-hmm. At least the last half dozen events that we've been to, both here, Singapore, and elsewhere, mainly in China, a one-fourth or one-third of the floor space of these large and expensive exhibitions are taken up by amazing, just in Guangzhou, something called the Guangdong Energy Efficiency Thing. There must have been 10 or 12 different brands I never heard of. They weren't on the screen. My question to you is, there's obviously going to be a consolidation. What, and there are companies like CLP developing technology to pull up, fill your car with electricity, zoom, or maybe not so soon, because there's no noise. The question is, preference, acceptance, what do you think the curve's going to be the next 10 or 15 years with electric vehicles in China, possibly?
Government wants it to happen because they want to avoid dependence on oil. They want to move to electrics. They don't want to go to hybrids because the technology is owned by the Japanese. They want leapfrog, go directly to electrics. They say they're offering subsidies for it. Cut right to your question, I think it's going to be a very, very long time. Why? Because the Chinese consumer, at the end of the day, very pragmatic, wants a reliable car, gasoline engine, convenient. I don't want to be the guy experimenting. So you're going to see government fleets buying, buses buying, but not a mass movement toward electrics and within the left. Definitely within 5 years, maybe 10 this year.
Okay, we've got a question down here.
Jane Singer. Yes, I have two questions for you, Mr. Gunn. One of which is, do you believe that from the get-go, the agenda was to do a joint venture, to learn the technology, to learn the marketing, and then dump that joint venture one way or another? That wasn't something that will evolve, but that was from the start, the plan? Not just within auto, but within other industries?
Well, yes, I do. I do.
Okay.
But not so much in a sinister way, as in more of a realistic way. So Japan also took this approach. Korea took this approach.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take it from a Chinese point of view, well, how do we get there? We'll work joint venture, and when we can do it ourselves. If the joint venture can hang around and be competitive, fine, we're not going to kick them out. But as soon as we can match them or do better, then what's the point of the joint venture? Yeah.
But as you also stated, you can't have a wholly owned operation there. So essentially, you're not allowing those guys in the market. And that brings me to my second question, is do you think at some point other nations that allow wholly owned ventures and no restriction on partnership, ownership, will start to change? Maybe that's off the track.
Yeah, no, I think it goes right to the heart of it. So in Detroit, for example, imagine China wants to export cars to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
No problem. You want to sell your cars in the U.S.? Let's use the same rules. You need to produce them in America. You can own up to 50%. We got a partner for you. The city of Detroit will be your partner. If you'd like UAW to be in there, too, I think they'd be interested. And if you want to repatriate any of the profits from America, of course, you need approval. You can't just take money out in dollars and turn it out. We need to keep the money here unless you have a very good reason to move. Why would you want to move it out? Just and that's not nothing dramatic. That's the same rules.
Hi, Tommy from The Economist. I just you mentioned at the very end of just this comment, repatriation. I can understand that if you have a growth market, you want to reinvest as much as possible.
Yeah.
So you probably would take all profits and put them back in the operation. But if you thought you were going to get squeezed out, you would want to take money out as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to act like maybe all the Chinese who are buying property in Hong Kong, Singapore, and America.
Mm-hmm.
Have any of the foreign joint ventures been able to repatriate any sizable amounts of money? Have they wanted to do it? Have they been blocked from doing it? You know, maybe strategically it would be silly right now and more importantly,
Yeah, in fairness, China has gotten more relaxed. So yes, there are instances of dividends being paid and repatriated in the last few years. But that wasn't a big part of that, and may close again. Right now, people I talk to in the industry say they're able to make dividend payments outside the country. So, but they need authorization. It's not just an automatic, okay, company decides, dividends paid, you still need to get.
You said is that the automakers?
Yes. Yes, so for example, Volkswagen has two joint ventures. At the end of last year, the joint ventures declared a dividend, and Volkswagen share was sent back to Germany.
Okay. Jeff Hasselwood, freelance motoring writer. These joint ventures, on the one side, FAW and SAIC, how keen are they to get their hands on European and US technology? And equally, how secretive are people like GM, Ford, Volkswagen, keeping their technology to themselves so that the Chinese cannot get an advantage?
At the limits on both ends. So the hunger is here, and the efforts to keep that technology. The globals don't want to share it. We're a joint venture. As one guy put it, he goes, I'm paid by headquarters to be a spy inside the joint venture. He's the CFO. Where's the money going? The joint venture pays me to be a spy in the joint venture because it's tough going.
Wegu with Reuters Breaking News. So Mike, thanks for your anecdote. And I'm wondering, who do you think is really the winners and losers out of that? GM, well, you portrayed GM as a victim, but at the end of the day, when it was in trouble, when China sort of given money, and also China's operation was its biggest selling point during GM's IPO. And China, as you said, has the most fragmented car market, and not so many domestic brands. So China doesn't look like the winner either, not SAIC, it doesn't have its own strong brand. So who wins and who loses?
There's a systematic thing going on here. That why hasn't China been able to build its own car 25 years later? It's not an inability to do so. So I'm looking, okay, why is this going on? The management at SAIC, just to take an example, or FAW or JPG, on the Chinese side, they're members of the party, maybe first, their government officials second, and third, almost as a hobby, they take it seriously, but third, they're an executive in a car company. And as executives in these joint ventures with GM or VW, they're making really good money. But they don't have a built-in incentive in their career to say, let's go get that technology and create our own car. That's a big risk, and they might not move up the party ranks, if they'd rather just status quo. So the original intention of forming these joint ventures is kind of a systematic issue that guys aren't incentivized to go and do that. Here comes BYD, Chery, and Geely. These are independent entrepreneurs outside of the system. They say, these fools at the state center, they're not moving things at all. We know how to build cars. We can do it. But the central government goes, BYD, Chery, Geely, did someone invite you? Where did you guys come from? Go away. Yeah, but they have their provincial factors too. Geely has, Zhejiang province and so on. You guys know the picture. So who's gonna come out on top? I gotta believe that in the end it's the powerful state enterprise like SAIC that maybe eventually buy Geely or Chery or get more entrepreneurs in there because they have the political power and the financial power. And now they have their own brand. But it's a slow process because they're not incentivized to have any breakthroughs. Look for SAIC, look for FAW, maybe Guangzhou. But the reason we haven't gotten there yet is because of the systematic sort of contradictions in the way to do stuff.
More incisive questions from Reuters over here.
Yeah, Alison from Reuters. It's a very interesting idea about maybe SAIC will buy BYD. So we all know BYD now in trouble.
Yeah.
But still, people are saying that Chinese makers might be able to compete with multinationals on the front of green vehicles, because more likely that green, they don't have the historic burden in production and battery technologies kind of leading in China. So what do you see about whether it is really true that you see Chinese automakers will be coming out from that front of competition? The other thing is BYD. What do you think about BYD? Are they really in deep shit? And is it Warren Buffett making a really wrong bet?
You can answer that in another way.
Right, who wants to volunteer to answer? As I understand it, the subsidiary in Warren Buffett's organization, American Energy, invested in BYD initially not counting on the car business at all. Their interest was to tap into energy storage capability for wind farms in the Pacific Northwest in America. As things happen, it comes out into the world, Warren Buffett is buying BYD car. And next thing you know, everyone's crazy about BYD. Well, understandably, if we can take this electric battery technology and marry it with car making, hey, maybe we've got our savior here. But it was really early days. Five-year-old companies could leapfrog everybody. It just doesn't happen. So BYD got way out in front of itself. It does make a decent car at a low price. It doesn't make proven electric cars yet. I'm not betting on that company. The first part of the question was whether or not they can actually leapfrog. Well, their dilemma is who do they choose to lead? You need, if it's in Japan or Korea, we've got one or two auto companies. We're putting all of our national resources into making electrics here. In China, they can't pick Shanghai. Well, wait a second. What about Beijing? What about Guangzhou? We can't play. What about Chongqing? And it's this fragmentation that stymies the leaders in Beijing. How do they get momentum around, necessary momentum around technology innovation when the industry is so fragmented? Yes.
Yeah, more noises.
Yes.
Hello?
Yeah.
Brian Rhodes. I had the luxury of buying a Passat for the Miura and a Buick for the Miura. So I did both. And anyway, I was curious about Ford. I know your book's about GM, but how did they, and they lost the battle in Shanghai, but I visited the Chongqing plant, and they seem to have been doing quite well, but I'm interested for your view.
Yeah, Ford is quietly doing, growing nicely. Just numbers, they have about a quarter of what GM has, so 2.5% share against 10% share. They have not had the right products until now, and they say that openly. They've had North American products and trying to fit in China. They're getting better on that. The other interesting thing to look at is the Detroit 3. Chrysler, from the beginning in Beijing, was highly confrontational with its partner, and that ended in tears. That joint venture no longer exists. GM has gone out of its way to say its partner relationship is superb. Not best friends forever. We love each other. SAIC, GM, great relationship. Ford is quiet. Doesn't see an upside doing either one, so it just sort of manages the relationship, and they're doing okay. They're growing, they got good products coming, they have some momentum. If anything, they could do a better job of leveraging the fact that they're an American brand. Chinese consumers love image, and when they buy a car, it's mostly about image. American car, cool. So that's, they're coming.
Okay, we can probably squeeze another one. Jeep.
Jing Chen, for Benisha. So who's producing a better car? The party Chinese, party long Chinese car makers, or don't interest the car?
Better quality? No question that joint ventures are still far superior in terms of reliability, quality fit finish design. Chinese cars are now low cost, low price, get you from point A to point B, but not highly reliable and not real strong when it comes to fit and finish and other design aspects. That was your question? The gap's closing. Chinese cars are getting better and better. At J.D. Power, we measured the number of problems you have in the first year of ownership. And the gap used to be this big between foreign joint venture cars and Chinese. Chinese are coming up, but there's still a gap.
Okay, I think we can take one more last question, which is over here.
Hi, Abhijit Bhattacharya. I'm with the Wall Street Journal. Can you talk about cash for clunkers? I think last week China announced what, by my count, is the second cash for clunkers program. How does that affect the market? Does it skew demand or supply, or you know, does everything the same as always?
Yeah, there's the scope for it, in my understanding, is kind of limited to commercial vehicles and trucks. It's not across all vehicles. So they're looking at trying to energize demand in areas of the country and industries that are needed most. So it used to be cars, small cars, and mini vans. Now they've shifted the attention. I think it's not a game changer. It's an incremental sort of push, but not a big deal. Not a big deal.
Well, Michael, I'd like to thank you very much. It's really nice to have a really meaty lunch. We have vegetarians here, but you know what I mean. Thank you very much indeed. And just to show our appreciation, this is from the FCC. This is if you should ever have to have a cherry car when it's raining. This will help you.
Thank you.